Good evening and welcome. It's KVZ Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Coming up December 10th in Upland, Affordable Music Productions presents The Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, including Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, The Original Times with Caesar Berry, and tonight's guest, Mary Wilson, one of the original Supremes. That's coming up in just about 15 minutes. First, though, it's time once again for Inland Pacific Ballet's Nutcracker, with performances at several Inland Empire venues. Rick Dulock has more in conversation with principal dancer Jonathan Sharp.
Jonathan Sharp is a principal dancer this year with Inland Pacific Ballet's production of The Nutcracker. Now a faculty member of the Idlewild Arts Academy, Jonathan has danced professionally with the Boston Ballet and the Pennsylvania Ballet, and has a long resume, which includes roles in hit Broadway shows, including The Red Shoes, Carousel, the Rocky Horror Show Live, The Dance of the Vampires, and Fiddler on the Roof. He's had additional acting roles on network television and teaches and directs all over Southern California. IPB's Nutcracker will have 12 performances in three theaters from November 26th through December 18th at Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga, Riverside's Fox Performing Arts Center, and Pomona College's Bridges Auditorium in Claremont. Details about the performances, when and where, are on their website at ipballet.org. Jonathan Sharp, thank you for joining me on KVC Arts.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, for many folks, myself included, The Nutcracker was my first exposure of any kind to ballet on television, I think, when I was a kid. What was your first exposure to ballet?
My first exposure to true ballet was my father had gone back to school when I was a kid to get his doctorate, and after he finished that education, we moved to a town. And I had been performing my whole life. I started in church singing and also doing theater productions. And then I had a mentor who had been on Broadway and did musicals with him. And we moved to a town after my father finished his education. And there wasn't really much theater to be offered, but there was an actual, honest, fantastic ballet teacher.
Okay.
And I was going out with a girl, and she sort of dared me to go to a class. And I said, oh, I can do ballet.
Right.
So I went to the class, and the teacher saw some immediate talent in me and theatrical abilities. And I started training daily. And the first performance that I danced in was The Nutcracker.
Oh, my goodness. And you had never seen a ballet before?
No. I mean, it's possible that I could have seen one, but I had never been to a full ballet.
Okay.
Never.
Sure. Well, most people listening this evening would recognize more than one piece of music from this production, but we or they might not necessarily know the whole story. Can you share a brief synopsis as you understand it?
Sure. So The Nutcracker is an ancient German fairy tale, and it's about a young girl named Clara, and she is at the Christmas party of her family, the Stahldowns, and her uncle, which is her favorite uncle, Drosselmeyer, comes, and he's kind of a pirate-ish character. He travels the world, and he always brings some fantastic entertainment to the annual Christmas party, and he brings her the gift of a nutcracker. And after the party, everyone has gone home from the party, she comes back down to the Christmas tree where she's left her nutcracker, and she falls into a dream, and she dreams that the nutcracker comes to life, and he battles the Mouse King and defeats the Mouse King, and then he takes her to the land of snow where the snowflakes dance a blizzard for her, and then the snowflakes whisk her and the nutcracker to the land of sweets where the Sugar Plum Fairy plans a big festival, and all of the different divertissements dance a big gala for her. There's the Spanish variation, which is chocolate, and the Arabian variation, which is coffee, and the Chinese variation, which is tea, and the Merloton variation, which is marzipan, and the Waltz of the Flowers, and then the Sugar Plum and her cavalier dance, and then they do a big finale, and then Clara wakes up.
And that, in a nutshell, is The Nutcracker.
Exactly.
You're listening to KVC Arts. I'm Rick Dulock. We're speaking today with Jonathan Sharp, a principal dancer in the Inland Pacific Ballet's production of The Nutcracker. And your character this year is Drosselmeyer, right?
Yes, I've played Drosselmeyer actually for several years. I love playing this character. You have to have trained and been a dancer for many years because there's not that much choreography per se for Drosselmeyer, but a lot of musical acting.
Okay.
And I'm also going to be dancing the Arabian in the production. And this year, for the first year, I am also the associate artistic director of the company, and I've done a good deal of re-choreography to a lot of the scenes.
Now, in some productions of this ballet, my understanding is that your character, Drosselmeyer, is sometimes depicted as a mysterious and magical yet kind character. In other productions, he's depicted as a rather dark and mysterious, perhaps even scary character. Which take on the character is the Inland Pacific Ballet taking?
You know, I think for us, we have a little bit of both. I think last year when I performed the role, people would come back and say, you know, you reminded me of Johnny Depp in The Pirates of the Caribbean. That was many more than one person said that. So I think the goal is to make him mysterious and a little bit dark, but never evil. The goal is never to make the audience afraid.
Ah, very good. And did you help create this version of the character in the production?
Yes, because typically in most Nutcrackers, Drosselmeyer is played as a much older character, you know, with gray hair, and oftentimes there's a stereotypical eye patch that he wears. Mm-hmm. But for me, we decided that we would keep him a little bit more young because my own person, I bring my own mystery to the characters. So we decided to keep him a little bit young.
Well, some productions of The Nutcracker include, like, extra-large forced perspective chairs and tables to make a human-sized mouse seem small. Other productions simplify the set. What's the case with the Inland Pacific Ballet and this production this year?
Well, one of the traditional pieces of scenery that you see in most Nutcrackers is the Christmas tree that grows to giant size. And we definitely use the forced perspective. We have a beautiful Christmas tree that grows to be enormous. And then you see the fireplace on one side turns around. It does sort of like a little tornado, and it becomes a giant castle. And on the other side, you see the piece of scenery, which is part of the house. It does a little tornado, and it becomes a giant dollhouse. So the battle, which is the battle of the Nutcracker and the Mouse King, takes place in front of the giant Christmas tree and the giant castle and the giant dollhouse.
So you do use set pieces then to set that size differential?
Yes, absolutely.
So what would you say your favorite piece of music to dance to within the ballet? What would you say was your favorite dance?
You know, for me, the most beautiful music is the end of the first act. Although, I have to say, there are so many beautiful pieces of music in this particular score. Tchaikovsky has written something amazing. But my favorite piece is the duet of the Nutcracker and Clara right before the snow scene. It's just such a coming of age for the character, and it's just so rapturous, and it builds and builds and builds, and it leads right into the snow scene. I think it's a gorgeous piece of music, but some of the other notable pieces of music that I think are just gorgeous is the Arabian dance of the second act, and also the Grand Pas de Deux of the Sugar Plum and Her Cavalier, which starts with the beautiful harp, just is so gorgeous, and then builds, you know, in that 4 minutes, it's like a symphony unto itself.
And many people say that the Nutcracker is a great way to introduce people to ballet. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes, I do, because the story is easy to follow. Everybody understands a Christmas party, and the characters are relatable, especially for children. So it's a really great production to bring kids to. They can follow the story very, very, very easily. And the divertissement of the second act, you know, you don't have to sit through a 20-minute ballet or a 20-minute piece. All of the divertissement are 4 or 5 minutes, so it keeps the viewer moving. They get to see something, and then they get to move to something else, and then they get to move to something else. And our particular production is beautifully colorful. We have a gorgeous Chinese dragon for the Chinese divertissement, and that's very fantastic. We have a dragon master who comes and works with the dancers to make that very, very authentic. And the costumes are fantastically colorful, and it just puts you in the Christmas spirit to see the production.
Very nice. Inland Pacific Ballet's Nutcracker will have 12 performances in three theaters from November 26th through December 18th, Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga, Riverside's Fox Performing Arts Center, and Pomona College's Bridges Auditorium in Claremont. We're speaking today to Jonathan Sharp, a principal dancer in IPB's production this year of The Nutcracker. Well, you mentioned it quickly, but I see congratulations are in order. You were recently appointed Associate Director at Inland Pacific Ballet. How has your role changed at the ballet, if at all, since the appointment?
Well, it's changed a great deal, actually. Last year, I started also helping be a ballet master, so I was rehearsing and in charge of getting the production ready. But this year, as Associate Artistic Director, the director, Vicky Koenig, has given me the responsibility of updating and bringing some artistic changes and rethought to the different scenes. So in the party scene, I've updated the parent dances and some of the adult activity to make it a little bit more intricate. I think initially it was choreographed for people who were not so much dancers. It was people who were just people being the parents, but now we have company dancers, so I've brought that up. We have redone the battle scene completely to give a little more stage fighting and to clarify the storyline. I also wanted to get the relationship between Clara and the Nutcracker to give that a little bit more development and a little bit more time. And because I've been on Broadway, I wanted to bring a little bit more of a Broadway Shazam to that scene. In the opening of the second act, I re-choreographed some of the bits to make the choreography a little bit more full and to involve the dancers a little bit more fully choreographically. In the Waltz of the Flowers scene and in the snow scene, like used to be the Dewdrop, who's the soloist of the Waltz of the Flowers, danced alone on the stage. But I felt like I wanted, because it was the end of the production, the Waltz of the Flowers towards the end of the production, I wanted to have more volume. So I have the flowers behind doing beautiful movement while she dances her solo pieces. So it's just a richer, more visual experience.
So even folks who've come to see the Inland Pacific Ballet and the Nutcracker before will have a new experience if they come.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's going to be interesting for me to see whether or not they go, oh, look, it's different, or whether they just somewhere inside them have a different experience watching something that they might have seen before.
Nice. Well, can you tell us in closing about perhaps your next role or something coming up in the near future?
Personally, I am going to be dancing with another company out in Thousand Oaks, close to Los Angeles. I will be dancing the title role in a new ballet, Noah's Ark, which is a fantastic original score done by the Pacific Festival Ballet. And it's just a wonderful thing that she's doing out there. She has a score written by a composer who writes for the movies, and then they take the score to Russia, and they record it, and they come back and edit it. And so we'll be doing that production.
Nice.
And for the Inland Pacific Ballet, we are moving to a new building in the spring, so we're working on that. And I'm looking to maybe add a series to the Inland Pacific Ballet's repertoire, like a cabaret series, where I can call on different friends of mine from Broadway and to create sort of a hybrid of musical theater and ballet. So that's going to be something that I'm looking to just expand the art form with.
Very nice. Jonathan Sharp is a faculty member at Idlewild Arts Academy and a principal dancer in the upcoming tour of The Nutcracker. They'll be performing The Nutcracker 12 times in three theaters, starting on November 26th and ending on December 18th, Lewis Family Playhouse, Fox Performing Arts Center, and Bridges Auditorium in Pomona. Jonathan Sharp, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope that your listeners will come and enjoy our production of The Nutcracker, and I absolutely assure them they will walk out of the theater in the Christmas spirit.
We're looking forward to it. I'm Rick Dulock, and this is KBC Arts.
Thank you, Rick. Again, more information on Inland Pacific Ballet's Nutcracker at ipballet.com. As KVC Arts continues, it's Music of the Supremes in conversation with original member Mary Wilson, part of the lineup with Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert. That's coming up December 10th in Upland. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. Coming to Upland December 10th, it's Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, including Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, Caesar Berry and the Original Times, and our next guest, Mary Wilson of the Supremes. Though they were known around Detroit first as the Primettes. We look at the Supremes as being born of Motown, but you actually had a couple of songs on Lupine Records when...
Yes, we did. We certainly did. And, you know, it's amazing because I didn't even realize that those recordings had been released. I found out about maybe about 5 years ago, I think it was, when I was in England, and someone brought some up to me to sign. I'm like, where'd you get this? You know, because we went to Motown Records and we auditioned when we were 16 years old, and Mr. Berry Gordy said, come back and see me after you graduate from high school. And so, in the meantime, a young man took us over to Lupine Records, one of the writers at Motown who happened to be in on the audition, and he says, you know, this record company, you should probably go with them. So anyway, we went over there, and we ended up doing a couple of sessions with people like Wilson Pickett, Eddie Floyd, and a couple of others, and so we did those. And we just weren't really happy about what was going on because at Motown, you could actually hear the recordings on the radio. You could hear Smokey Robinson, you could hear Mark Johnson, and you could hear these people on the radio. So we're like, that's where we want to be. So we left Lupine and went back over to Motown and just started hanging around for months until we finally got, you know, sort of noticed. But that's how we ended up doing those recordings with these people. And like I said, we were so young, we didn't know what they were going to do with those records. And right. Years later, I found out they had actually released them.
It's beautiful stuff, Pretty Baby and Tears of Sorrow. And this has actually you on some of the leads there. So that's a really cool thing for us. When you were hanging out at Motown, as you said, the way that I read it is you eventually convinced Gordy to be able to do background vocals and hand claps behind folks like Marvin Gaye and Mary Wells and whatnot. Are you by chance the hand clapping and the echoing My Guy behind Mary Wells?
You know, we did so many little things that I can't remember all of those. The ones I recall, I don't think we really did anything behind Mary Wells. We may have done hand clapping or something like that, but we never did any backing vocals for her, that I'm sure of. But other things we could have. We did do Marvin Gaye, Wonderful One, which was actually a little later. Wonderful One, and is it Can I Get a Witness? I think we did one of those with him. And we did some other, lots of backing vocals for people, but those are the only ones I can recall right now.
When you started to record as the Supremes, I'd love to hear about the picking of the name. Do you recall some of the other names, and did you like any others better than the Supremes?
No, you know, because what we did was when it was time for us to sign our recording contract, Mr. Gordy said he didn't like our name at the time. We were called the Primettes.
Right.
So he said, I don't like that name, so if we're going to sign this contract, you need to get a new name. And each of us went around and asked our friends and our neighbors and our teachers, because we were still in high school, for a name. So I don't recall any, and only Supreme stuck out. And it was amazing. But they were all kind of, because everything was about the gender. You know, it was like L's, Ets, you know, like Raylette, everything had that because you had to denote if you were a female or a male back in those days. It was very important. So everything kind of ended in that. And that's how Supremes really stuck out because it did not have that gender sort of spelling behind
it.
And so Florence picked it out. But years later, because I don't even think she remembered who put that name on it because we were just writing names as people would say them, right? And years later, Janie Bradford, who was one of the writers of Money by Barrett Strong, told me that she had put that name on Florence's paper. So that's where the name came from.
The first hit, Once You Were the Supremes, When the Love Light Starts Shining Through His Eyes. Now, did this one feel different? Because I feel like when you were the Primettes, it was more of a maybe a doo-wop-y sound to it. Some of the Drifters type tunes and all that kind of thing. But the sound of the Supremes started to have much more of an orchestrated feel than the lead and the call and response sort of doo-wop sort of thing that we had.
Well, when we Primates were recording initially at Motown, our songs were really stemming from doo-wop and things that were on the radio at the time. And we were recorded by Berry Gordy, wrote some songs for us. Barney Ailes, who was the sales marketing guy at Motown, wrote some. And even Smokey Robinson wrote a lot of our songs. So they were stemming from that era, you know, coming from the 50s and all. It was only when Mr. Berry Gordy put us with the writing team of course, as everyone knows, Holland Dozier Holland, Brian and Eddie Holland, and Lamont Dozier. When he put us with them, then our sound did start changing, because they were a whole different animal. You know, they had their own sort of sound, as we all know. And that's when, yes, our whole dynamics really changed. One of the first was Love Light Shines Through His Eyes, and then they did Run, Run, Run. and we really felt we were on our way as the Supremes at that point, because, you know, we felt the difference. We knew the difference, and it was, like, really exhilarating to be with Holland Dozier Holland. So we were very happy. When Love Light Shines Through His Eyes came out, we thought we were on our way.
Nice.
To have a, you know, a hit record. and we were, because I think it was first Bubbling Under, and that was, like, so exciting.
Oh, yes.
The Billboard.
So there's no questioning of a new sound. It was more of an embrace of a new sound. It's like, this is what's going to make us make it beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Because, you see, it was also during the time we were getting ready to graduate from high school. Maybe we had graduated, just graduated. And so we needed to have a hit record so that, you know, we wouldn't have to go to college.
Yeah, you had to justify.
Our parents all wanted us to go to college, and they had saved up their little pennies. Mm-hmm. And so it was very important, you know, to get the education. So we were so excited when we heard this record, because, okay, we don't have to go to college, we'll become stars.
You know? Nice.
It's like really funny.
That's Mary Wilson, part of the lineup of Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, along with Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, and Caesar Berry in the Original Times. That's December 10th in Upland. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. As you started to have song after song climbing the charts, you know, Where Did Our Love Go? Of course, that was the first number one. If you could think about this, tell me the first one that you thought should have made it, or at least higher than it did. Maybe one of your favorites, and then, you know, it was totally overshadowed by that Stop in the Name of Love again.
Well, you know, I'm not quite sure. I never really cared for the first couple of songs, and I always say this, and it's more to do with me knowing or thinking what we the Primates were. We were very good as the Primates, but we couldn't get that hit record. So all of a sudden here comes Dozier Holland, who gives us these five consecutive number ones, which they were really different. Where Did Our Love Go? Baby Love. They were kind of more of a, I know everyone says we were R&B because we're black, but I mean, they were more of a pop sound.
Right, yes.
Than that, you know. So we were really different than most of the other acts. Most of the other acts were R&B, which we wanted to be R&B because we wanted to be soulful.
Sure.
But, you know, we ended up being this kind of popish kind of group. And the records were, to me, really baby bubblegum kind of songs. You know, didn't really care for them that much. Of course, when they became number one, it was like, yes, we got a number one. So we were thrilled, you know.
Yeah.
So I think the first one after the first couple, I did really love Come See About Me, you know, because that was getting more into the kind of R&B-ish kind of sound, you know.
Yeah.
But what's really strange is my first one that I absolutely loved was I Hear a Symphony.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And, yeah, because it was mature. And you have to understand, we were like teenage girls, and we wanted to be really mature because everybody else was a little older than us. So we wanted to be more mature, and I Hear a Symphony was that song. So those first ones, even though they were our number one, just personally, you know, we weren't as thrilled. Because would have loved to have had some of Martha and the Vandellas songs, you know, Dancing in the Streets. That was R&B. That was, like, cool.
Right, right.
But we had to embrace that. We were a little different than most other groups, you know. We were, as it showed when we went on, we started doing the nightclubs, you know what I mean? We started doing that kind of thing. So we had a different persona, let's put it that way.
Absolutely.
Than what we had in our minds.
Well, you know, that's a wonderful way of putting it, because that's something that did stand out more than the, say, the doo-wop kind of thing. there is this elegance about you. The three of you, well, four of you at one point, but came out and struck a pose before the first note was sung. And I understand, and you please correct me if I'm wrong, but in the earliest of days, I actually read this as a quote. So the style of dressing and performing was, quote, carefully choreographed by Barry and the Motown staff. Tell me about this. Wigs and gowns, not the standard doo-wop?
Yeah, well, I can't give them that credit.
Okay.
And that's not to take anything away. What I give Motown the credit for is recognizing that that's who we were.
Nice, okay.
So they didn't have to create or make an image for us. We came in there with the image, and what they did was embrace that image and help to cultivate it. And that was done through many people. There was Mr. Charlie Atkins, you mentioned the choreography.
Yeah.
Mr. Charlie Atkins did all of our choreography. You know, he came up with all of the great movements, the hand gestures. As you mentioned, we came out and struck a pose, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it was having those great mentors at Motown that helped us to develop into who we became.
Gotcha.
But we came in there with, you know, wearing our little pearls and our little gloves and our little, you know, all those kind of things. This was for them wonderful because they were able to then help us to grow into these glamorous girls. But I have to say, that's who we were before we came there. Even though even though the pearls were bought from Woolworth,
sure.
Even though they were cheap, we still had the elegance, and it proved to really pay off. And thank God that that's what I give Motown the credit for recognizing that. Yes, and I gotta also remember the other young lady who was very important to the look and the style of the Supremes and all the Motown acts actually, and that was Mrs. Maxine Powell. We always said etiquette teacher, but she says, I'm not an etiquette teacher because you've got to learn how to use your spoons and forks at home. You know, I don't teach you that. I teach you how to embrace the beauty that you are inside and to walk tall and da-da-da. She said, you're diamonds in the rough, and we're just here to polish you. And I just loved when she said that. And to hear that when you're 16 years old, it's like, wow, cool.
Yes, indeed. I really love the fact that they didn't put the elegance on you, that they recognized it within you and embraced it. That's a beautiful quote there. Couple of early things, and again, you still had to be only 17 or so. You were still living in the Brewster Projects when you performed for Prince Charles and Princess Margaret and the Queen.
Actually, by then, we had just moved out. You know,
okay.
We had just made enough money, and you're really right about that, but we had just made enough money to buy our parents homes.
Nice.
So we were still virtually just out of the projects, but we weren't physically living there, but we, you know, that's where we were. It was just amazing because it was standing up there with the Queen Mother. You know, I'm thinking about this. It's going through my head like, my God, here we are, three little black girls from the Brewster Projects, you know.
Yeah,
it was quite a step. But, you know, it did take a long time, you know, because we started singing at the Primettes when we were 12 and 13, 14 years old, something like that. So, you know, we still were very young. We were still teenagers.
Still figuring it out.
I just remembered another group that we used to work with back in those days, and that was the Falcons, because Wilson Pickett came out of the Falcons.
Oh, my gosh.
A couple of the Stubbs were there. Levi Stubbs' brother was in the Falcons.
Oh, wow.
Actually, I gave Eddie Floyd an award at the Rhythm and Blues Award show in Detroit, Michigan, just 2 months ago. And, you know, we kind of discussed that we had known each other all those years, although I hadn't seen him in years since I was like a little kid. So that was really cool, you know, that we're still seeing some of these people that I started out with years ago.
That's one of the beautiful things about these concerts. It's such a reunion for all of the acts coming on board.
And I know they're having a good time kicking it backstage before even coming on to sing the hits of yesteryear.
Yes, it is, because actually the Times and the Supremes worked together back when we used to do the Chitlin' circuits all the time. We did the Apollo, the Uptown in Philadelphia, and all those different venues. And I recall that the Times and the Supremes, we became very close friends for several years after that. This will be a pleasure to work with them again. Of course, some of the originals are not there, but
right.
The other guy is. And so it's really great, you know, to be able to be back and talk and see each other after all these years. So it really is a reunion of types, which is really cool. Now, I've never worked with the Clovers, but of course, I was a teenager when their records were out. And I tell you, I remember them so very well, because they were some of the best years of my life, you know, being a teenage girl and hearing all these great new music, because then it was new.
Yes.
You know, it was like really, really new, and boy, it's just great. So I'm happy that they're still having these type of shows so that this music can be brought to life so that people can see what we grew up listening to.
That's Mary Wilson, part of the lineup of Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, along with Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, and Caesar Berry and the Original Times. That's December 10th in Upland. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com. More from Mary Wilson just ahead. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. We are online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming to Upland December 10th, it's Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, including Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, Caesar Berry and the Original Times, and tonight's guest, Mary Wilson. And while Diana Ross did provide lead vocals on most of the Supreme songs, occasionally Diana would introduce a song with Mary on the lead.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Miss Mary Wilson.
You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. You'd be like heaven to
I hope to be able to tell Frankie Valli this someday. I have a new favorite version of Can't Take My Eyes Off of You. I guess we got this in 1969. I didn't get it until decades later, but Wikipedia, by the way, lists Nancy Wilson as the one who covered this in 1969, not you. But with this song, you were about to tackle a Frankie Valli giant. So this song, or others maybe, I would love to hear what you put into your mind's eye, as it were, when covering someone else's material. You know, you want to pay tribute, you want to make it your own. So I'd like to hear about what's inside before you even open your mouth to sing.
I actually don't think we think about covering the song. I think what you do in singing someone else's hits, let's say, you find a song that you like and it touches you for some reason. And I recorded Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, and I used to do it live when we did our live performances. It was one of the only solos that I had, because I basically am a ballad singer. So back in those days, I did most of the ballads. And Can't Take My Eyes Off You was one of the songs that I chose because I just loved the lyrics, and it was a ballad. And I could do it live on stage where I sang it at the Copa and, you know, all over the place. But that was one of the solos that I did with Eddie Kendricks of the Temptations.
Oh, okay.
And recorded that. So if you haven't heard mine, you need to hear mine and play mine. Personally, I mean, that's the way I look at it as an artist. You find a song that you personally connect with, and that's what's on your mindset.
Wonderful.
Not so much of trying to emulate or cover or do better. It's just what it means to you.
That's beautiful. I have to say, it's also quite nice to be able to see an old video clip with Diana Ross saying, "Here is Mary Wilson." That is, okay, bring her up front. Good. Well,
Oh, did I just say that to you?
She liked to say that. That was the introduction she enjoyed doing. You could hear it in her voice. You know, and here is Mary Wilson.
Yes.
Miss Wilson, there are a few things that I want to ask you about that are not at all music related, or at least getting away from the songs, and we'll get to that in just a few moments. We're talking about the Humpty Dumpty Foundation and truth and music legislation, but a couple of things that I do want to ask you about before we get to that. This is, again, going back 35 years or so by now, but when Diana left the Supremes, it was at this point named Diana Ross and the Supremes. So when she left, was there any worry that, okay, people would be looking at it as that Diana Ross group, not the Supremes? And of course, it really was just the Supremes, and they slapped her name in front of it a few years earlier. If you just believe. So were you looking at it as people are going to be looking for another Diana, or are people going to be supporting the Supremes, this wonderful group that still is?
Well, my personal opinion about that is that I think the audiences really wanted more of the Supremes, whether it's Supremes or whether it's Diana Ross and the Supremes. And obviously, since Diana Ross was leaving, they were now saying, okay, Supremes, well, you know, who's going to be there? As Diane was such a formidable person out front, we did need to really come up with a good sort of music, first of all, presentation.
Right.
You know, so recordings would be that. And I think, actually, it was Mr. Barry Gordy who brought Gene Terrell in. And I was very worried what we were going to do. I knew either I'd have to disband the group, because it really was up to me if I wanted to continue it on, or try to come up with someone. And obviously, they all tried to come up with somebody. And my mindset, nobody could do it, because no one really could replace Diane. But we were so very fortunate that when Mr. Barry Gordy brought Gene Terrell to my attention, he said, Mary, I think I found the one. And we all were looking. You know, everyone was looking. But it basically was really up to me, you know, what would happen. Because I wasn't going to go out there with someone that I didn't care for, period. That was my mindset. And when I say someone I didn't care for, I mean, I'm talking sound and, you know, personality,
sure.
The whole package.
Sure, right.
The whole package. But when he brought Gene Terrell to me, first of all, she was so different from us. She was the R&B element.
Ah.
But also, she is a great singer. So Mr. Gordy said, this is the one, Mary. And I'm like, okay, sure, show me. And as soon as I heard her, as soon as I saw her, I'm like, okay, I'm in. It's it.
Perfect.
Let's go for it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
So that was a great thing. And she really did bring something different. And that was what made it work. She was different. She had a different style, a different look. She was more black, let's say. She was R&B, but she also could sing her butt off. And so that was what sold everybody on it.
Beautiful.
And we had some great recording. And the best thing was we then were put with Frank Wilson, who came up with the greatest of songs. I mean, Stone Love,
yes.
Up the Ladder to the Roof. I mean, he brought the goods. So the whole package was great. The only thing we lacked was we didn't get the complete backing that we needed, you know, to really do it. But, I mean, we had it. We had it there. Something just kind of happened. I don't know what it was.
One more thing about, I guess, looking way back, and this may be an introspective thing, but I read that you've kept a journal all of your life. Is that true?
Yes, I have. I got to say, the last 20 years, I've not done like I used to do at all. I mean, I periodically will write something. But, yeah, I grew up keeping a diary because my teacher told me I should become a writer. And he said, when we were just getting ready to graduate from high school, and he told me, he says, Ms. Wilson, I know you're still running around with that little group, the Primettes. He said, but if you don't pass my class, you won't be able to go out on the road and tour. And so I had to buckle down and really do well. And he was an English teacher. So I did. I actually passed his class, and I sent him this paper that I had written, and he gave me an A++++, and he said, Ms. Wilson, this is brilliant. He says, you know, I think you should just forget that singing and just become a writer.
Oh, my.
Well,
wow.
I'm like, thanks for passing me. All I want to do is just get out of here and get down to Motown. But something must have struck something in me, because Motown was like this beautiful organization, and it was so great to be around all these talented people. I mean, we were around geniuses, you know, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye. We were around all of this and all this music constantly. Four Tops, Temptations, everyone was doing something great. And so I started, just when he told me that, I just started writing down every day. We'd go to Motown and write down what was happening, all the new people, all of this. And it just stuck. And it's something I just continued to do all my life. And then that led to me actually sitting down and writing the book.
Right,
my
right.
book, which Dream became Girl. A bestseller. Oh my, Mr. Boone, you were correct.
There it is.
So, and he was very happy with me, and we corresponded for years until he passed, and he said, I'm so proud of you. And
oh, beautiful. Da-da-da.
There
beautiful.
You go. Mm-hmm. I need to say this to some of your listeners, the young ones. So do listen to your teachers. Sometimes they know what they're talking about. Sometimes.
And they won't believe it. Oh, boy. I'd love to hear about a couple of very important things, and one of which, Truth and Music. But first, tell me about the Humpty Dumpty Foundation, please, and your role within it.
Actually, yes. The Humpty Dumpty Institute is a great organization. They do projects all over the world, and they asked me if I would become the spokesperson to their organization. Now, previously, Princess Diana was the spokesperson for the landmine clearances. It had to do with the old bombs that were had been dropped on Vietnam and Okinawa and all these kind of places. In different areas, not just there. The bombs are still there, and people are being maimed by them. Children get the scrap metal to take to get money for their family, whatever, in these areas, in those various areas. And so when Princess Diana passed, I was asked if I would come in to become a spokesperson, which I loved the opportunity, and so I did. And I actually traveled to Laos and Vietnam. I traveled to all kinds of places, Sri Lanka, and we would help the villagers to find these bombs and then explode them.
Mm.
I was part of that for years. I'm still the spokesperson, but they've kind of moved on to other projects. They do different projects.
Okay.
And so that was just one of them. And then we did some feeding hungry children in different areas, so I was part of that. And I have pictures of it. I've got to actually do something with them. But, yeah, so that's what I did with Humpty Dumpty Institute, and they're really cool. They do just lots of different kinds of projects.
Wonderful.
Now, the Truth in Music field is something that I'm really proud of, and a lot of the doo-wop groups and early groups were a part of this. It was a grassroots movement that I, and as I mentioned, a lot of different artists, some of the Drifters.
Yeah, I've spoken with Charlie Thomas about this, by the way.
Charlie,
yeah.
That's right, Charlie. There were lots of different groups. I mean, it wasn't a black and white issue. It was like across the board. What would happen is people started taking... Let's just put it right out there. People started stealing the names of famous groups, and they would form their own group and go out and perform and do the music of these groups. And so we got together, some of the original artists got together and formed this group, and we started lobbying to get this legislation passed. And it was called, as you mentioned, Truth in Music. I guess about 30-some states have passed that legislation. We really have got to get it in the federal courts.
Yes.
To actually stop these groups from doing it. Because the biggest joke was any given night, you could see the Drifters, the Coasters, and somebody else in every country in the world.
That's right.
On the same night.
Yep.
Now, how could that be? Now, you couldn't have that done with the Rolling Stones.
Yep.
Or the Beatles.
Yep.
But with lesser-known groups maybe no longer existing or working, then people just pop up and do it. We have three or four different Supremes. So there you go. So that's what we were trying to stop with this. And I'm very happy to have been a part of it. And Charlie Thomas, as you mentioned, as well.
I think it was Charlie that told me about, with all the different groups calling themselves the Drifters, that included, get this, three 30-something-year-old white guys in Germany calling themselves the original Drifters.
Yeah, because the music is so wonderful. You know, the music is so wonderful, and people love the music, and people can sing. It's not about them not being able to sing.
Oh,
so
yeah, yeah,
then when the audiences go, they want to hear the music, so they just go and hear the music, no matter who's singing it.
Yeah.
And that really is very unfair because some of the groups, the original groups, they died very unhappy.
Yeah, very anonymous.
You know, their legacies have been stolen.
Yeah, truly, truly.
So there you go.
Yeah.
So that's why we did it.
Good, huh? It's a beautiful cause. People need to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
As we wrap up, there are just a few more things. You and the Supremes, truly did set the stage, of course. I mean, that goes without saying, but, well, I just said it.
Look, there were lots of females, the Shirelles and the Chantels and whatever. But what happened with the Supremes is that we came along when TV came out, you know, and so we were on TV every day. And so I think that kind of helped us get over so many other groups, is because we had that visibility and the world was able to see us.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
Can I tell you what I'm doing today? I know this is about the doo-wop, and I
yes,
just want
please.
To say that I do have a record on the Billboard charts. In fact, my record, Time to Move On, went to number 17 on the Billboard charts, on the dance charts, just recently. And I was, like, totally surprised, because I did it in England with Lee John, and we just did it for fun. And some people picked it up, and this record company released it. So there you go. So that's one. And I'm just really happy to say that another project that I did years ago ended up on a compilation. So it's up for the Grammy Award.
No way.
Yeah, but I didn't even know about it until recently. It won the first set of votes. And so I just called the Grammys to see if I can vote. And my voting dropped. So I've got to reinstate myself so I can vote for this record.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it's called You Dance My Heart Around the Stars. It was done by Gus Dudgeon years ago, in the 70s, I think it was, or 80s. So I worked with Gus Dudgeon before he died, and it was just great. The Supremes never got a Grammy. So if I can get a Grammy, it would be my first Grammy.
Oh, my goodness. That's hard to believe with all the hits that you had and that the Supremes collectively had. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, I know. So I need for people to vote for it.
Well, I'll tell everybody that I can.
I just found out yesterday.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? So now I got to try to reinstate myself and become a voting member of the Grammys. I was wondering why they never sent me anything.
If we have any Grammy voters listening right now, please go vote for Ms. Wilson.
Yeah, Steve Kalinch, his name is. Yes, go on there and check it out. So anyway, there you go. That's my new things, and that's what I'm up to now. Still traveling. Got my gown exhibit on the Supremes gowns. I'm writing my third coffee table book on the gowns. So I'm just keeping myself busy. I do have a website, marywilson.com, you know.
Okay, good.
They can find out what's going on. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to know about any more books in the works, and so good, you answered that one. Whenever you're doing shows that do include the 50s and 60s performers, do you ever go ahead and still include, say, things like Time to Move On or maybe Red Hot, some of the disco stuff from 79?
Red Hot. No, I haven't done that.
Oh,
no.
Red Hot. Come
but,
on.
No, haven't done it. It's a different world out there nowadays, so, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, when you do a doo-wop show, you've got to do the hits that people know. You know what
sure.
I mean? They,
yeah, they're going
you gotta do. You got to do that. I got booed once at Madison Square Garden because I was doing some of the new 70s songs, and people just wanted to hear the 60s.
Oh, gosh.
You know? Oh, yeah, it was not fun. So, you know, you need to do whatever you're there to do for the people, to keep the people happy.
Well, this ties into one last thing here, and I'll make it the last thing because it ties in so perfectly. I was watching a video of a concert performance, and I don't know when it was, and that's really off to the side. But you made a statement. I have to be honest, I teared up. In essence, it was, let's make people happy, the world happy. You don't fight wars when you're happy.
When we do Someday We'll Be Together, I do a little monologue at the end, and I say different things, but that's some of it, yes.
That's fine.
Yeah, because if you're happy, you're not going to go out and fight. I mean, why are you fighting if you're happy?
Yeah.
And that's true. And music makes you happy. And so we don't want to have war. So everyone needs to be happy.
Yes. Is Someday We'll Be Together, is this by chance your closer? I mean, you can surprise
yes.
us if you wish. Yeah?
Yeah, Someday We'll Be Together is the closer, yeah.
Nice. All right.
And that's where I usually say those type of things, yes.
Beautiful. Well, those are beautiful words. And like I said, it choked me up when I read it and choked me up as I was trying to say it to you just now. Yeah. Miss Wilson, I look forward to meeting you in person.
Thank you.
All
thank
right.
you. Thank you so much. Hey.
Mary Wilson, headlining legends of R&B and doo-wop live in concert, along with Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, and Caesar Berry in the Original Times. That's December 10th in Upland. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com. Back and wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Mary Wilson and to Nathan Goethals with Affordable Music Productions. Thanks also to Jonathan Sharp with Inland Pacific Ballet. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Lindsay Boyd, and General Manager Alfredo Cruz. Beyond the music of Mary Wilson, the Supremes, and the Primettes, music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. You can find past KVC Arts programs at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.